On today's Caped Wonder Superman podcast, season 2 is finally here, and we are ready for 2020 with episode 21.
And with a new season comes a new adventure as we spend a new decade talking about the Superman sequels, starting with The Lost Lester Notes.
Now, the Caped Wonder Superman podcast with Jay Towers and Jim Bowers on iHeartRadio.
Hello again, and welcome to the Caped Wonder Superman podcast. I'm Jay Towers in Detroit. If you are a first-time listener or a loyal podcast downloader, we ask you to please subscribe to the podcast on iHeartRadio or Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen to podcasts, and be sure to share it with your super friends. Speaking of super friends, the best part of this podcast, in my opinion, is our super co-host and friend, and that is the founder of CapedWonder.com and the ultimate Christopher Reeve Superman legacy historian just outside of Las Vegas. Can you top an intro like that? Jim Bowers.
Hi, Jay. I don't think you can, and you're most kind, sir. I really appreciate it, and right back at you.
And it's going to be a great year.
Oh, it really is. I can't believe we're on season 2 already. Episode 21. We're going to try to shoot for 20 episodes every season. And we're going to start it off with a big bang because we're going to be talking about sequels and a whole lot more. Some of the highlights of last year for me, Jay, was having Sarah Douglas in your studio in Detroit where all three of us were together. And of course, when Aaron Smolinski came here to Vegas. And we were also together at the iHeartRadio station. That was really, really fun to be together to interact and have a great time. So much information came out of last year that we didn't know about. And that's what's so cool about these movies is that we're always learning something new.
Absolutely. I mean, if you were to put together the perfect jigsaw puzzle of 5,000 pieces here that make up this entire legacy, who would think in 2020 we're still finding new pieces? But we are. And that's what makes this great, because even when you hear some of the stories you may already know, there's always something new that we're learning for the first time as well. So that's going to be a real focus for us this year, talking about the sequels. And we certainly want to do our best to get more Superman Reeve legacy guests this year.
We're going to have some really nice surprises, including some Oscar-winning folks that we're going to be talking to in future episodes. How about October 2020? Isn't that going to be one heck of a good time?
Boy, you talk about fans. Already hearing from so many people that are doing everything possible to get to the Royal Albert Hall in London. Now, let's talk a little bit about that. How did that come together, and what is this?
Well, this event is happening October 27th. 2020 at the Royal Albert Hall in London. Now, I've been to London, but I've never been to the Royal Albert Hall, and our friends, including Sarah Douglas and David Michael Petru, have been there and said it is just a miraculous place to hear and experience live music. And it's called Superman in Concert. Again, it's part of a concert series that it has been going on for a while, both in overseas and in the United States, where some of the more iconic films like Jaws, Jurassic Park, Raiders of the Lost Ark, E.T., Empire Strikes Back, and many, many others are being shown on the big screen with a live orchestra performing the score. And I've never experienced anything like this before. And when I heard that Superman was happening, I'm so excited. I ran right to my wife, Sally, and said, hey, we got to do this. And she was all for it. So we're already planning our trip. We've already got our outfits picked out. It's going to be a really fun formal event. A lot of our UK friends are so excited that both you and I are going. And so this is supposed to be the ultimate experience as far as sound quality goes. So if you have never seen the Royal Albert Hall, you can Google it, and it's got some just gorgeous pictures of the place. But you'll want to buy tickets really, really soon. I bought them as soon as they became available. So if you do have the opportunity to make it, try to do it. Try to save your pennies and get over there. We're going to have a nice Caped Wonder and Caped Wonder podcast gathering. And you can click on the Superman in Concert events link on our podcast page on Facebook so we'll know you'll be there. This is the theatrical cut, by the way, they're going to show. But it's going to have some bonus surprises, and I can't really reveal those at this time. but something really, really to look forward to.
I want to play this clip before we get into Superman 2 and the Lost Lester notes. I want to just take us back to December of 2019.
Listen. Now, ladies and gentlemen, one of the greatest items in the auction this weekend, by far, the Superman Christopher Reeve Warren movie cape right here. Yep, got 100, now 125. 100's bid, 125. 100's bid, 125. Worth $200,000, 125. Next bid, 160,000 going once. Now is the time to bid. 160,000 going twice. Fair warning, any other bids? Sold, 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 155,000 at Julian's.
Wow, what an auction. The Julian's auction, and Jim Bowers was there. What was that like?
Unbelievable, Jay. Really, really unbelievable. I'd never been to in person to a big auction like this. And this was definitely a record breaker as far as Superman costumes is concerned. Certainly the most high-priced cape, let alone entire costume. This is a cape that was the second Superman the Movie contest winning prize back in early 1979. Now, some of you may be familiar that there were two contests that went on to promote Superman the Movie. Jay, we know about the first one. The first Superman movie contest involved two winners actually getting to be in the movie. And they ended up being a couple boys, 13 and 14 years old, who got to be football players in the Smallville High School football team. And we remember seeing those two guys in gray uniforms. I'm sure you remember that. And they
Sure.
were in the same scene with David Michael Petru, who made his cameo. And this cape is the second Superman movie contest winning item. And what you had to do was go through many different DC Comics issues and titles over a three-month period and find the letters page and answer these trivia questions. There were 25 of them. And it ended up that only 21 people got all 25 questions correct.
And when they had to pull a winning name for that cape, Christopher Reeve himself pulled it at the DC Comics office in New York. And I'm sure that guy was really, really excited.
This cape was won in February of 79. It accompanied a letter from DC Comics editor Sol Harrison congratulating him. From there, it got auctioned in 1997 in New York at Sotheby's Auction. And a man from Sweden won it. And he's the gentleman who decided to sell it with Julian's Auctions this past December. And after fees and all that other things associated with auctions, the final selling price was $193,750, if you can believe it. And I did go. I've gotten to know Darren Julian, the owner of the company, and of course, Jason DeBoard, who's the longtime and well-known editor of Original Prop Blog, has now joined the executive team of Julian's. And I was invited to photograph the cape on December 15th last year, which is actually Superman the Movie's birthday. Mm. Got to set up my studio equipment there in their showroom in Beverly Hills and spend the whole afternoon photographing this magnificent cape. And then the following day, Jay, is when the auction took place in the afternoon. It was about a 4.5-minute auction for just this item. And, of course, it was the showpiece of the entire day. And a gentleman on the phone won it, and when he did, he started screaming on the phone. He was so excited. I had a feeling this cape would really bring in some good money just because of all the provenance and the history. This is the holy grail of Christopher Reeve capes, in my opinion. Photographing it was a great delight for me. 2018, you might remember that I had the opportunity to photograph an entire Superman III Evil costume with my buddy Ramon Casares from Argentina, and that costume sold for just over $200,000 with Julian. So these costumes are going up and up and up. And, you know, and that costume had great provenance because we were able to identify the exact scenes it was used in because of a flaw in the seam on the shoulder.
Right.
And because of the shape of the S shield. So if you're in the market for an authentic Christopher Reeve costume or just a piece of a costume, definitely talk to Jason DeBoard. Run it by me if you like. We have some other enthusiasts out there that have done a lot of research to help you determine if you've got the real deal. Yeah. But I was so excited to be there. It was definitely a highlight for me last year. I don't know if it's going to get any better than that as far as costumes go. Wow.
Hey, quick note here. Jim, let's quickly say hello to our friend, The Deal of Steel, who did a great video for us promoting our new season of the Caped Wonder Superman podcast. And that video starts with 42 years later, the influence of Reeve remains. Just a great example of how the Christopher Reeve Superman legacy continues to live on. And any Superman fan from the Reeve legacy will watch those episodes and go, wow, this is great. And great to see Brandon Routh.
Oh, it really was. Of course, I loved seeing the Caped Wonder Sun City newspaper, the evil Superman moment that happened. And I thought Brandon looked fantastic in the Kingdom Come style costume, much more than the Superman Returns costume. He looked great, and he looked like he was having a great time filming. And of course, that ending at the during the last episode of him doing the flyby over Earth, of course, doesn't get any better than that, Jay, and I don't think it ever will. But what a nice homage to Chris actually looking at you at the end of the movie. Remember how exciting that was when you were watching Superman the movie and suddenly Superman looks at you at the end of the film? I mean, that was just that's the best.
That's what we call breaking down the fourth wall, right? I mean,
that's right.
That's what it is. And at the very end, it lets you know that you were in on it the whole time.
Right, and they were smart enough to do that for every single ending of these films, including the Donner Cut. And go back and watch those sequels again. You'll notice that some of the sequels have a different take of the same scene. And there's also a unique take in the making of Superman the movie of that flyby. So,
all right, that said, let's do this.
Now, the Caped Wonders Superman podcast with Jay Towers and Jim Bowers remembers 1981's Superman 2.
Ah, Superman 2. How could we forget it? Taking a time machine back now to 1979. Now, we know Donner is no longer part of Superman 2, and now Richard Lester is in charge of the most anticipated sequel ever. And it is a good time to welcome back an amazing contributor to CapedWonder.com and a great friend of the podcast.
Yes, indeed. We have our first returning guest, Mr. Bill Williams. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Jay. It's a pleasure to be back with you.
I've known you, close to 25 years, I think, back in the Superman cinema days, in the early days of the internet. And Bill, over the years, has done an incredible amount of research and work for us and for the fans, and has built the ultimate chronology, production chronology, for all of these movies, which we've been resourcing and referencing now for quite a while, and it continues to grow and change. And in fact, you just sent me an update this morning. Thank you very much, sir. You know, unlike George Lucas, who cataloged and archived everything in a nice, neat warehouse where it was easy to pull from and figure out what was done where and when, these Superman notes and history is kind of scattered all over the globe, and we've managed to pull it together, a lot of it. And I would say one of the most challenging films to decipher is definitely Superman 2 and what went on to get that movie on the silver screen.
Oh, I completely agree, Jim, because with all the history of Superman 2 and everything that both Richard Donner and Richard Lester brought to the project, there's been so much that has been written about Superman 2 and has been discussed and debated and everything. There's still so much even more that's out there, you know, that's still waiting to be uncovered, that we're still putting together even as we speak.
Absolutely. And Jay, we recently came across some really, really interesting vintage production notes as it's related to Lester's tenure as director.
That's right. We're calling these the Lost Lester Notes because we can't find any record of these notes prior to now. And boy, there are a lot of them, pages of them. And I guess the best place to start is by listening to the words of Richard Lester himself.
The basic problem was that the first film, people went to it and said, prove that a man can fly. They go to the second film saying, of course that people can fly, now show us something.
All right. And Christopher Reeve kind of said the same thing in that Making of Superman 2 special.
What have we done to top part one? I think that what we've done is to unify the style of the picture a bit more. part one, we had the obligation to tell the backstory, all the history, to take you all the way to Canada and growing up and all that kind of stuff, which was fine. It was lovely. But now we've done the exposition, and I think people will enjoy seeing that we start off with action from the first frame. You know, it's just boom.
And that's exactly how the Lester version of Superman 2 kicked off in theaters back in 1981. But Bill, I'll ask you first. You had a chance to look at the lost Lester notes here over the last couple of days. There is a lot to take in. What are your initial thoughts?
First of all, Jay, what I think really interested me is that there were some story outlines that were developed before David and Leslie Newman came aboard. First of all, a story outline from April of 1979. There were two of them, as a matter of fact. The big mystery of those two particular story outlines was who developed those particular notes. Was it the Salkins? We don't know. We don't have any information about that. And yet so many of the ideas that were presented in those two story outlines wound up in the final version of the film. Of course, there were little differences here and there. It said that Superman had thrown a nuclear reactor chamber into outer space. That obviously got changed into throwing the elevator into outer space, and that set up the whole Paris scenario. They were looking at phasing out Jor-El to some degree and bringing Lara in, but also involving Jor-El to a lesser degree, which would have meant using the Marlon Brando footage to a smaller extent. So there's a definite transition period between the Donner era and the Lester era when the Newmans came aboard and really solidified the story. And that's one of the big, great mysteries about these new outlines that have surfaced recently.
All right. And just for the sake of the fans out there, as a little reminder, David and Leslie Newman were involved in the Broadway show in the 60s. They were brought on to do some rewrites back during the Superman the movie planning, along with Robert Benton, who was a successful writer and director. That script was finalized and tweaked a lot by Tom Mankiewicz. The film got done early 79. They decided to replace the director. And along with that, David and Leslie came back, as you said, Bill. And some notes and changes had already been made before they returned. And that's who we don't know who actually did those. So by the time May 79 rolled around and David and Leslie were back, that's when the script really started taking the form that we saw in the final theatrical cut of Superman 2. A couple things jumped out at me that, you know, we all three read recently was that they were considering whether to bring Marlon Brando back because he had decided he wanted more money for his likeness. And obviously we know that he didn't. And they were also trying to decide if they were going to bring back Jimmy Olsen and as well as Gene Hackman and Valerie Perrine, who did not, of course, come back for Lester.
And Jim, just to touch on what you're talking about, now we have some real evidence of what was going on April 10th, 1979, when they were making these decisions. Listen to some more of the Lost Lester notes. There remains the question whether the Marlon Brando material may or may not be used in Part 2. Should this be the case, new scenes in the Krypton trial and the Fortress of Solitude will have to be worked out, using Faces of the Elders and Lara to make the story points. And the person who wrote this preamble, as it's called, really had the job of not only kind of deciding what was going to happen next, but also the money that was going to be spent. Because when discussions happened around the Daily Planet, the exact quote from the memo is, "The rebuilding of Perry White's office and the planet is not so much a matter of expense as floor space. The art department should offer up ideas." So this is really kind of a response to that earlier outline we talked about where somebody went through and went, whoa, wait, let's talk about this before we just start going forward.
Yeah, in fact, I was looking at some notes also typed up in April of 79J, where it says Clark gets his powers back in the fortress from Jor-El. And then just a little while later, no Jor-El. It's now back to what we saw in the movie. So, yeah, they had a lot of decisions to make, and it's really fascinating to watch this morph into what it became. But I guess by the time May 79 came around and David and Leslie came back, I think a lot of decisions had already been made about the cast and what characters would return, and film new material. And then, of course, he had to edit it all together with material Donner had shot. And on that topic, Bill, I know we've gone back and forth about how much footage or what percentage of two we think Donner shot. And I don't think we'll ever know the definitive number, but certainly it seems to be in the neighborhood of maybe 70%. And the final theatrical cut of Superman II, it only ended up being about 33% Donner. Is that right?
That's correct, Jim. A lot of people have said that Richard Donner had shot approximately 75%, even as much as 80% of Superman II. But when you look at the final theatrical version of the film, only a third of the film is actual Richard Donner footage. Richard Lester had shot more than 50% of the film in order to obtain sole directorial credit. And in the final theatrical version, it's a good 65, 66% of the film that is Richard Lester's footage. It's a much different film. It's much different in tone and style and footage as well.
The Lost Lester notes also make a lot of references to either shooting new plates or finding existing plates shot to really put this film together. Let's just talk quickly about plates.
When they talk about plates, a number of the plates that they used for Superman, the movie, of course, were shot from a helicopter. And Al Serial is the helicopter pilot who's still working in Hollywood today, who filmed all those magnificent New York City plates. And in order to keep the costs down and get the movie done, they actually had no new footage of New York City in Superman II. So, yeah, they talked about front projection plates, optical plates for blue screen. There were a lot of decisions that needed to be made in cost cutting. They didn't have to travel to New York and shoot any plates, or they didn't have to take any actors to New York. So it's funny that Terrence Stamp, Jack O'Halloran, and Sarah Douglas are never actually in New York City for any scenes in Superman II, the magic of film. So there you go. Anytime you see Clark Kent or Lois Lane walking down the street in Superman II, it's a set. And so while they did have to spend the money on the sets, I guess that was cheaper than doing all that traveling and B-unit filming, etc.
Jim and Bill, the Lost Lester notes talk a lot about the Fortress of Solitude for Superman II. And in these notes, it goes like this. As things stand at the moment in the outline, we shall need to re-erect the interior of the fortress, but with many modifications for simplicity of shooting. I hope we can keep it to a three-sided set, giving ourselves a large acting area on floor level, particularly for Superman entering and leaving the restructuring chamber. There is a lot of talk about the fortress in these notes and the Daily Planet.
Well, basically, Jay, they had two major sets to recreate. The first one being the Pinewood Studios Daily Planet set. And, of course, that was built at Pinewood initially during the Donner years in 77. And they rebuilt that. And there are some minor differences that you can tell that help you distinguish between the Lester years and Donner years. One of them just being that the color of the phone next to Perry White's desk is white during one and black during the other. But one of the biggest expenses was the Fortress of Solitude interior set. Back in the Donner years, it was filmed at Shepperton, and with Lester, it was built in Pinewood. And of course, they did a lot of alterations to make it a little easier to film in. The molecule chamber is different in the Lester years, and just the whole layout is a bit different. And Bill, what are some of the differences you can tell in a nutshell as far as that fortress set go?
Well, one thing I noticed is the crystal chamber that Superman uses to access all of the memory crystals. In the original set that built in Shepperton in 77, the crystal set is much higher up on the set. But in the Pinewood set that was built in 79, the crystal set is down towards the center of the stage, the center of the set, if you will. And there's a lot less green, if you will, throughout that fortress set, whereas if you notice in the Richard Donner footage, there's a hint of green throughout the set as well.
I think it made it easier also for Richard Lester's camera crew, since he did often use what's called the three-camera setup, where he's filming a scene with three different cameras simultaneously. It probably made it easier for them to do camera setups if there weren't as many various levels to have to mount the cameras to. Again, it's a time-saving method, and obviously saves money as well, just easier access all the way around.
In addition to redoing the crystal chamber, they also had to construct a kitchen set. They had to construct a bedroom. They had to completely redo the restructuring chamber for this new film. And then also they had to construct a library, which I don't think we even saw in the film, in any version of the film.
No, I don't think we did, but we did see that beautiful dining room where he pops the champagne bottle. That was pretty neat.
Indeed it was. That was one of the big tasks that Peter Merton had to undertake, you know, following in the style of John Barry. He had to successfully continue on what John Barry had built back in 77, had designed back in 77. And I believe he did a fantastic job expanding the fortress set beyond what was originally designed and planned.
As many of you may know, John Barry was the production designer, and he had passed away while he was working on the movie The Empire Strikes Back, so he was not able to go over to the Superman II production and continue on his work. But yes, I thought they did a marvelous job, Jay and Bill, with continuity overall. Imagine the daunting task of trying to blend new footage, new sets with existing footage, and all of the hours they must have spent with John Victor Smith, the editor under Lester, having to go through all of Donner's footage. And as we know, Donner filmed a lot of footage for both films simultaneously, just in his effort for perfection.
You know, when fans see us promote this podcast, The Lost Lester Notes, they wonder what things were supposed to be in the movie and maybe didn't happen. And listen to this. A scene where they, quote, chase Superman to a forest where after Lois and Luthor get parked in trees, a terrible battle ensues. In the course of it, we pull back to reveal this is actually on the side of a volcano. And this goes on to say the furious activity causes the volcano to bubble and then erupt. The red-hot lava threatens Lois most specifically, and Superman must save her. Having done so, he takes off. Lois feels like she has been abandoned and is rightly upset.
Yeah, that is really interesting, Jay. I read that a couple of days ago about both Luthor and Lois being stuck in trees or in the forest while Superman continued to battle with the villains. And in another version, they fly by the Eiffel Tower, and Zod punches the tower and cripples it. And Ursa hangs Lois on the end of a piece of metal hanging off of the Eiffel Tower and just leaves her there.
Well, you go through so many versions of these scripts to find things that were supposed to be in Superman and Superman 2, and many end up in 3 and 4.
As far back as 1976, when the Newmans were writing the script to Superman and Superman 2, they had included scenes where Superman straightens out the Leaning Tower of Pisa and then at the end goes back and corrects the Leaning Tower of Pisa again at the end of the story. So those elements were as far back as 1976, and yet they eventually evolved into what we saw at the end of Superman III in 1983.
Initially, he did it because he was so happy about his relationship with Lois. He was going to get the flowers and the dinner, and on his way back to the fortress, he straightens the leaning tower, and then later makes it lean over again. So that I found that fascinating, as well as the souffle scene.
I have to tell you something. I've never done this before.
Don't worry, you're going to be fine. Just don't rush it.
Okay.
Okay, stop. Hmm?
Okay. You should never overcook a souffle.
Right.
There it is. And here's the crazy part. In 1976, in a very early script, it reads Lois saying, "Well, I expected a lot of new experiences tonight, but I wasn't ready for raw souffle." And Superman says, "Oh, that's not a problem." And she goes on to say, "Stop, never overcook a souffle, you'll learn." And Lois goes on to say, "It's so nice to have a man around the fortress." The Newmans go on to do the same scene, saying, "Superman, I've never done this before, I have to tell you." Lois says, "Hey, don't worry, you'll be fine. Just don't rush it." When Mankiewicz gets his hand on the script, it says, "Lois, slowly, not too hot, stop, never overcook a souffle," with Superman saying, "It's easy when you know the chef." Lois is supposed to kiss him and say, "Oh yeah, wait till we get into roasts and poultry." And how interesting that this scene was rewritten so many times and never made it into the theatrical cut.
Right, it didn't make it in there, but it, I think the world first saw it, Bill, in the TV extended cut, and then the restored international cut of Superman 2. As we know, like Superman the movie, there was a TV edit of Superman 2 in 1984, and there it was. And there's actually a widescreen remastered version of it in an extended Donner cut, which we're going to talk about in future episodes. So finally, we have a nice, clean version of it, but I always found it to be quite a charming scene.
It's one of the more interesting scenes that Richard Lester filmed, because it does show a great moment between Chris and Margot in that particular sequence, in that particular setting. It's really interesting that it did show up in the TV broadcast and then, like you said, in an alternate version of the Donner cut.
Let me ask you guys about continuity, because it is an important word in any film, and especially with these films.
Listen. Some of the footage was shot more than 2 years previously and is cleverly blended in with the new material.
Yeah, talk about those Forger scenes. And what about the Daily Planet scenes as well when the villains arrive? Because there's always talk with the fans about the length of Lois Lane's hair.
Right. And in fact, in Superman 2, Margot Kidder wore wigs throughout the movie. And I've never heard a definitive reason for it, but I do know from looking at photos of her during the Donner years, they constantly had to put her hair in curlers between takes because her hair would appear too flat. So I think to make it easier, they put her in wigs. Yeah, you can tell that. And you can also tell how tall and how much older Mark McClure looks between Lester and Donner years. And his hair is a lot longer in the Lester years. So there's a lot of back and forth in that villain invasion during the Lester theatrical scenes. All of the attack parts of it where you see the villains come in, of course, is under the Donner years. And then there's a lot of back and forth between Lester and Donner in Perry's office. Yeah, it's quite a puzzle to unravel. If you watch it long enough, you can tell other differences where General Zod's hair is a little more gray and curly. And Ursa's hair is, she has less bangs in Superman 2. Her hair maybe looks a little slick back or wetter, if you will. But isn't it fun to try to go through scene by scene, shot by shot, and go, "Oh, okay, yeah, that's Lester. Oh, nope, that's Donner." And that's what Bill spent so much time doing with this article we now have on CapedWonder.com called "The Circle Is Now Complete." We actually time-coded and broke down by time code Lester versus Donner. And if you've got a bunch of time, you should read through it. It's fascinating.
That's been one of the most enjoyable parts of researching Superman 2. I've been working on that actually for well over 20 years.
Wow.
And every time I think I've finished it, I come back to it and I realize there's more to it. So that will continue to evolve as time goes by and I learn even more information about the film.
Well, guys, can you think of another movie series where this has happened? We've gotten not only a theatrical cut, but we've gotten a new re-edit with the Donner cut. But scenes also contain both Donner and Lester work in the same shot. For instance, when the crystals come up from the Fortress of Solitude and Lara appears before Superman, you've got Donner background plates of the fortress combined with optical crystals and a control center that Superman's standing in from the Lester years. So they not only cut together two different directors' work, they actually blended together the work via optical effects.
It's really fascinating to put all these pieces together and see exactly how much Richard Donner footage survived into the Richard Lester cut and see exactly how much Donner and Lester footage were combined, as you said, Jim, in the same shots. So it's a fascinating puzzle, and we'll still unravel all this as time goes by.
Well, right. You said the other day, or maybe yesterday, Bill, that it's never ending. And that's what's so exciting about this. We've got new things to discover on a regular and constant basis. And that's what keeps it fresh. And I love it when the fans write to me or call and say, hey, I've discovered something else new. And it's like, wow, I never even thought about that. But that's what's so exciting about these notes from the early 79 before they started filming under Lester, which was around August of 79. It's just the evolution of these scripts are just magnificent.
I don't think we'll ever stop learning.
Anybody that's got information that maybe we haven't talked about or you haven't read about anywhere, feel free to email me or contact me. I'd love to know what you know.
In early 1977, there was a memo issued, Fight Over Metropolis, which was also a part of a step outline that Donner did for Superman II. And it's interesting to see what in that outline of the Fight Over Metropolis made it into the Lester version, what was shot and what wasn't.
Right. And one of the things that's in these notes that I had a good chuckle with is Superman is in midair and he flies over to Ursa and thumps her on the head, knocks her into the Statue of Liberty, and then he turns around and punches Non in the face and hits him in the Empire State Building. So it's just they obviously were having a lot of fun with all the different possibilities. And of course, a lot of times it boils down to, can they pull it off visually? But yeah, this document, January 24, 77, think about that date now. That's right after Donner got hired and before Christopher Reeve was cast. So this is really, really early. And it's kind of a bullet point document of just ideas of different things they wanted to do. Like, for instance, Lois was going to fall in a garbage truck instead of in a fruit stand when she jumped out the window of the Daily Planet. Just a lot of little things that you go through there and go, oh, that might have worked. That's interesting. Maybe that would have worked better. But for one reason or another, it got changed.
And you think of a scene where, you know, Ursa was allegedly supposed to be standing on a children's hospital. And that would be that moment where Superman feels like he needs to leave now or else the city's going to get destroyed. And here are these kids, sick kids in a hospital. Again, what a great storyline of showing, you know, how vulnerable he can be when trying to hurt people, regular people.
Right. And it was, the mind over muscle thing where he said to himself, the best way to save these folks and to save the city is to get the villains out of town. And that's why I was fascinated by these notes that talked about on his way to the fortress, the villains were chasing him and you see them doing different things. And, in the final cut, of course, he disappears. We don't know where he's going and we don't know until Zod's hand is crushed that he's reversed the molecule chamber powers to turn the villains into mortals.
Yeah. Zod roars to the crowds below, go to your homes. So what a great scene that would have been to see General Zod kind of addressing these crowds of people in Metropolis, basically telling them to go home. The fight's over.
And isn't it interesting that in none of these early notes, guys, is there a mention of them using super breath to stop the crowd that decides they want to take on the villains? That must have come along quite a bit later.
I agree. It has to come at least after the May 79 draft that the Newmans worked on. And another thing that I found interesting is that there was a note in that May 79 document that says that Superman arrived at the fortress and started hotwiring the restructuring machine, which confirms that, you know, it backs up what he does at the end of the film when he turns the switch on them and causes them to lose their powers. It's only in that May 79 document.
That's right. And it reads, at the fortress, Superman is seen doing something mysterious at the crystals and the restructuring machine, but we have no idea what, if anything, it means.
Right. There is a really interesting battle or a fight in the fortress that he obviously expanded from the Donner scripts. And we can talk about all those unique superpowers that Lester introduced into the movie that fans have talked about for a long time.
And one thing that also emerges from the May 79 document is that it's the first time that the super memory loss kiss at the end of the film is also referenced. It's not in any of the previous drafts or any of the previous step outlines as well. And that goes back a number of years, almost 20 years, to the comic book origins as well. Superman II is a really really good tribute to its comic book origins.
Recently, I put out there, Bill, on Facebook for some of our comic book expert friends to tell us if any of these unique powers have shown up in the comic books. And one of them was the Super Kiss. There was a form of that that showed up in a 1963 comic book. So that's not something Lester just pulled out of thin air.
April 10th, 1979, Clark sees her great dilemma and, as an act of mercy, kisses her. It is the only kiss in the film. It has magic fairy tale properties, wiping out all memories in her mind. She no longer knows the secret she knew a moment before. She asks Clark to get her lunch.
Right, exactly. And another note that I found interesting is if you look at the Lester cut, you know, when it looks like once Superman has defeated the villains and they are just they're left at the fortress, it's in the May 79 document. It's not until after the final battle that a tailored planet headline reveals that Luthor and the villains are taken to jail. It's never explained in the film, but if you watch the extended version, it does show that they are arrested at the Arctic. This document definitely confirms that Luthor and the villains were, in fact, arrested. Why that was never confirmed beyond the Donner footage, we have no idea.
Right, and these lost Lester notes. After Luthor tries to betray everybody, Superman pulls the restructuring machine trick, reversing it, turning the three into mortals. One way or another, they are all knocked into crevices. And then it says, cut the following scene with Luthor and the paddy wagon.
Yeah, I saw that too. Just a day or two, Jay, I thought that was interesting. You know, this was just all part of going through the Donner footage and deciding what they definitely wanted and did not want. Boy, did that team have the work cut out for them. Is Superman 2 the theatrical? Do you guys consider it sort of the definitive cut, really, though? I mean, I know we love the extended cut of Superman the movie, and we've seen the TV edit of Superman 2, but I think the theatrical cut is a pretty fine edit. I think it flows really well, and it showcases the best of you know, all the action scenes that were shot.
I have to agree with you. I mean, what Richard Lester did was he brought a cohesiveness to Superman 2 by filming in all these extra scenes and filming in the necessary scenes that would bring the film to a completion. And there's a lot of great moments. You have to give Richard Lester a lot of credit. There's some great iconic moments that still hold out to this day. The scene of Clark running through the alley and changing into Superman. The final shot of him returning the American flag to the White House and filling in the gap, the middle part of the story.
Yeah, that's a good point, Bill. People always respond so positively to that alley change transformation from Clark to Superman. And it's quite a hypnotic, stroboscopic type of effect that was done optically in an optical printer. And the Salkinds actually did that, or a form of that, for the opening credits of the Three Musketeers. So obviously they had remembered that and used it again. But, you know, it doesn't get any better than that. And it's such a great homage to the comic book transformations that we saw over the years as well. And the American flag thing, of course, I ate that up, you know, the apple pie and, you know, all American way. And me being a veteran, I just appreciated that ending so much. So, yeah, you know, Jay and Bill, there's so much to love about Superman 2. And I'm so glad we're here today talking about it because there's so much to talk about with this film. And I do applaud Lester and the team for pulling it off so well. I mean, it was a hugely successful film like the first one. The first 3 days in over 1,300 theaters, it made $14 million plus dollars. And was pretty much head-to-head with Raiders of the Lost Ark that entire summer of 81. They released it in overseas first to take advantage of the peak summer season in each respective country. So the people who saw it first in the world were people in Australia, and it wasn't until the following summer that we got to see it in June of 81. Think about the marketing effort for this film and the first film. They just did a fantastic job all the way around.
It just exploded like gangbusters. And for me, it was the perfect summer movie.
Oh, it really was. I remember driving over to our local theater in Georgia. I lived right outside of Fort Benning, Georgia, since I'm an Army brat and an Army veteran. And I went over to my favorite theater that I'd seen so many movies in already, and there was that Coming This Summer teaser poster with the three villains. Isn't it interesting that the first poster or the teaser actually showcased the villains and only had Superman in a small inset photo? So there was a real push and a real belief that this villain encounter was going to be, as they say, a cosmic battle for world supremacy.
Hmm. You know, on this podcast, we talk a lot about nostalgia and the spark that brings us back to loving these films so much. And I kind of think of it the same way one might think about finding jurors for a trial. You typically want a juror that doesn't know a lot of specifics and won't form an early opinion before going through the entire trial. And that's how I think about Superman 2. We are so tuned in to the fact that, you know, Donner was let go, Lester was brought in, there's this Donner cut that came out, there was this footage, there was his vision, and we sometimes need to remember that the Superman 2 we saw in theaters as kids is the Superman 2 we remember and loved, and not until now do we get kind of jaded a little bit about it. And, you know, as I watched the original Lester version last night before we did this podcast, I thought, wow, this moves really fast. This was a really great movie. I remember it as a kid. And to this day, it still sparks that nostalgia in me because I saw it when I was 6 years old in 1981. And it doesn't take anything away from the Donner cut that I love and that extra footage that I love. But this is the movie that sparks the nostalgia.
And it really is a fantastic live-action comic book. That's how I see it. Whereas the first film, and I think Bill's described it as more of an epic adventure, a three-part adventure with sweeping camera moves and all of that. The second movie is like, boom, comic book time. We've got these villains. We've got all these fantastic things that they're doing. You know, fighting over the city of Metropolis. I thoroughly enjoyed it. You know, when I go see a film, especially the first time, I just try to sit back and just take it all in and not try to figure out, well, how did they do that? And how did they do this? And then I might start digging in. Well, God, I'm fascinated. How did they make him fly? You know, how did he change into Superman in one scene? So I can still go back to a film I'm very familiar with and just try to just enjoy it for what it is and not try to dissect it too much or think about all the things behind the scenes. And that's the way I think you can really enjoy these is kind of forget about everything and just, you know, zone everything else out in your mind and just enjoy it for what it is.
And for me, on one level, it's about a guy liking a girl and wanting her to like him for himself. Because in the first film, you have Superman wanting Lois to like him for him. But in the second film, you have Clark wanting Lois to like him for him and not being jealous of himself, because there's that one moment where she says, that's what friends are for, right? And Clark is heartbroken and everything. And as a teenager, for me, at that point in time, for me to see it, I mean, who can't relate to being called a nice guy? But that's what Lois is calling him, essentially, in that movie. In this film, you've got Superman dealing with four bullies, you know, who are coming in, who are thinking they're big, bad, and everything. They want to take over. They want to ruin everything. They want Superman just to cowl at their feet and everything. He doesn't. He stands up to them. There's a lot of great things about Superman 2 that speak to me from that time when I was a teenager, and I had to deal with all that myself.
Well, right, and you're talking about four bullies, so you're including Lex Luthor, and then, of course, there's a fifth bully, Rocky in Don's Diner. He was a bully as well. Of course, he didn't know that this guy was Superman, but or was at the time he punched him. But I also feel like some of Chris and Margot's best acting is in Superman 2. For instance, when he stands up straight and turns around in the Honeymoon Haven Hotel, says, I don't know why I did that. And that's a fantastic scene. So I'm always going to have great affection for 2 for different reasons for my affection for 1. And I think you're with me on that as well, Jay.
Absolutely. And I think at the end of the day, if you're a fan of the Reeve legacy, you cherish every drop of every footage of every film, and that's what's important for fans. But as standalone movies, I mean, you know, Superman 2 is great. I think, guys, that's going to wrap up our discussion for today. But boy, do we have a lot more to go this year, as it is,
wow,
as Jim mentioned, the year of the sequels. We certainly need to talk about the restored international cut. We need to talk about the versions that ran on television, and of course, the Donner cut, and how different that was compared to the movie we saw, and how wonderful it was. So we've got a lot more to do this year, Jim and Bill.
We surely do, and just so the fans know, I've been talking with Warner Archives for a long time now, and as you know, they did a great job releasing Supergirl and the extended cut of Superman the Movie on Blu-ray, so I'm hoping that we're going to have some more Superman sequels out from them. I don't know when yet, but I'm going to keep you posted as I can, so I think we have a lot more exciting things to add to our library. It's not over yet.
I'm excited about what 2020 will bring, and it's like we've said, this is just beginning. There's so many more stories to tell about this particular film and all of its different incarnations.
Thank you so much, Bill. And Jim, that wraps up episode 21 of the Caped Wonder Superman podcast, season 2. And today's an exciting day because I know there's so much more to talk about, and we have so much time to do it and so many more episodes to record. So we certainly are already excited about what's coming up next. And I'm hoping that we're going to get this special guest that we think we're going to have at the end of the month.
Yep, I'm working on that, Jay. We're going to come back to Superman 2 at some point this year, a few times. I'm certain of that. But we do have a special guest we're lining up. And just as a teaser, he's recently released a book about his career. And we're going to be going through that page by page before we bring our guest on. And I've recently found some more information that's going to make that episode really, really special. So something to look forward to soon.
We encourage people to check out all the great things you have at CapedWonder.com, and you've made some really great updates to the website.
Yes, I have, and it was a lot of work last year. My website designer and I work closely together. He's a fantastic guy, a real problem solver, and we wanted to figure out a way to improve the galleries so they're easier for you to zip through and see all the wonderful imagery, and we've accomplished that. And I hope you'll give me some feedback and let me know via email or private message what you think about it. But now we've got a gallery that works really well on your cell phone. And I know the majority of you tell me that you visit Caped Wonder on your phone, and that's great. And we appreciate that. And there's always going to be some surprises and content on CapedWonder.com that I may not put on social media right away. So it's best if you visit both our Facebook page, our podcast page, as well as CapedWonder.com. And as always, I'm so grateful for your continued support and enthusiasm for this great movie series.
And if you've listened this far, do us a favor. Would you jump onto Apple Podcasts and please subscribe to the Caped Wonder Superman podcast? It certainly helps us out, as well as the iHeartRadio app. If you're listening there, we thank you for subscribing, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Have a wonderful week, everybody. Jim, we'll talk soon.
See you later, Jay. And everybody out there, stay super. Talk to you soon.
You've been listening to the Caped Wonder Superman podcast on the iHeartRadio app. Jay Towers is a Detroit TV anchor and morning radio host on 100.3 WNIC Detroit. Follow Jay on Instagram and Twitter at Jay Towers. Jim Bowers is the founder and editor of CapedWonder.com, the home of Caped Wonder Superman imagery. Follow Jim on Instagram at Cape Wonder and on Twitter at Cape Wonder Jim.